We're going to start the State Government Finance Committee. We do not have quorum yet, so we won't be able to officially act on anything yet. But once we do, we will interrupt what our proceedings are. But out of respect for the people that are here, I want to make sure that they get a chance to maximize the time here. So, Representative Jurgens, I'm going to call you first. Just so you know, when we do get quorum, I'll just stop you so that we can take care of the business and move the bill.
Thank you.
So to that, Representative Jurgens, you want to present your bill, House File 4392.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4392, and I don't know, there is an amendment. I don't know if you've got that. It inserts.
There is, and once we have quorum, we'll move that.
Thank you. So House File 4392 is very simple, and just to give you a little background on this bill, many of you remember on Thursday we had a special guest here in the House of Representatives, Afton resident, my constituent, Jesse Diggins, who won, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Representative Jurgens, we do have quorum now, so this. Let me just take a moment here. Members, in your packets, you should have, do we have minutes today or no? I missed that. Got the meeting minutes from April 12th. Representative Pugh, you want to move those minutes?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move the minutes from April the 12th.
Representative Pugh moves the minutes from April 12th. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, the minutes are adopted. With that, Representative Jurgens, I'm going to move House File 4392 be laid over for possible inclusion to the State Government Omnibus Finance Bill. And I am also going to move the A180768 amendment. Members, this will get the bill in the order that the author wishes. All those in favor of the A18 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the amendment is adopted. Representative Jurgens, to your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I was saying, last week we had Jesse Diggins, Olympic gold medalist, was our special guest here at the House of Representatives. I reached out to Jesse through her family after she won the Olympic gold medal and invited her to the House of Representatives, initially just to be recognized on the House floor. For her achievements. In working and visiting with her mother, I learned that this topic was important to her, and she wanted an opportunity to talk to many of you, to representatives, about the idea of bringing a World Cup ski event to Minnesota. And so from that discussion is where this began. I set up a meet and greet so that Jesse could meet all of you. And then working with you, Madam Chair, and staff to find out what more can we do to help move this along. This idea of bringing a World Cup did not start with me. It has been in the works for quite some time. I do have testifiers here from the Lopet Foundation and others who have been working on this. This was the intent of this bill is to assist and to supplement the activities, the efforts that have already been made to bring a World Cup to Minnesota. And, Madam Chair, that is my bill. The amendment just adds the word cup, which is more specific to what the event would be. And with that, I've got testifiers, if you're willing to see them.
That would be great. If you can have your testifiers come forward, please. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
John Munger.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you. So I could just give you a little background on the World Cup idea. As Representative Jurgens alluded to, about a year ago we received a call from Jesse Diggins after she had competed in a World Cup ski race in Quebec City, Canada, and was very jealous of the Canadian athletes who had the hometown advantage and people cheering for them while they were competing. We haven't hosted a World Cup in the United States since 2001. And what is a World Cup? Well, World Cups are essentially the Super Bowl of cross-country skiing. They take place over a number of weekends in the winter, typically in Europe. Over the last several years, Canada has started to have some World Cups now, and Quebec City is the main location for that. But there hasn't been one in the United States since 2001. The one prior to that was in 1987 in Bewavik, Minnesota, Giants Ridge. The big things that we're working on this, and really since she won her gold medal here a few weeks back, we've been working much harder at it. It's something that is a financially challenging thing to put together, but with Jesse's charisma and her ability to represent Minnesota so well, The opportunity has really presented itself in more relief now. We are up against some timeline issues. the calendar for this 2020 World Cup, which is what we're trying for, March of 2020, will be put together in the next 4 or 5 weeks here with the International Ski Federation. And in order to get on that calendar, we need to have confidence between us and U.S. Ski and Snowboard that would be kind of co-sponsoring the event that we can make this work financially. So we're working very hard to put those financial pieces together. If we can do that in the next, say, 2 weeks, then we'll be able to try and get on that calendar. So that's kind of what we're up against here. And, you know, we're really happy that Representative Juergens has offered to try and get this bill put together to give us a little bit more support in these efforts.
Great. Thank you. I've got Ms. Byrne and Mr. Johnson and anyone else that wishes to testify. If there's anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Amateur Sports Commission. We're pleased to be called into Representative Juergens' office to help assist with this bill. Our role really seems to be somewhat of a coordinator. You know, our real charge as an agency is to promote amateur sports and to promote sports tourism. Both of those are contained in this bill, so we're happy to help in any way that we can.
Great. Thank you. And then Berkness? We're good? Okay. All right. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify to this bill? All right. Members, any questions? Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a question. And who would be in charge of putting this event on? You know, we have the Final Four. We have different groups that come in here. We have big conventions and so forth. Is this a combination of different organizations that would cover this?
Mr. Munger.
Thank you. This would be an event that would be put on by the Lofoot Foundation in conjunction with U.S. Ski and Snowboard. That's the national governing body for cross-country skiing.
Representative Detmer.
And Madam Chair, and would there be a fundraising exercise going on too during this time frame? And exactly what amount does it take to put on an event like this?
Yeah, so we've been sharpening our pencils over the last year. This is about a $1.3 million event to put on. Between U.S. Ski and Snowboard and some of their kind of endemic sponsors like L.L. Bean, for instance, and some of the work that we've done with, say, Minnesota Tourism, but also with our projections of what we can do for charging ticket fees and so forth for the event. We're thinking we can cover about 700,000 of that, so there's 600,000 that we're out right now beating the streets trying to figure out.
Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Detmer?
Thank you.
Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Juergens, thank you very much for bringing this effort forward. I think it's a great thing for Minnesota, and it's pretty exciting what the women have done in skiing sports with Diggins with the gold and Lindsey Vonn with her great career of success, and I saw her at the Country Music Awards. I was watching the other day on TV. She's probably going to go to New York for Representative Omar's movie premiere over the weekend to introduce her, maybe even. But it's just amazing what it's done, and I know it inspires a lot of people beyond the participants, but to have us as a focus for the state and the country and the world. And, of course, the Olympics really helped and the effort. Thank you so much for bringing it. It was great to meet her especially, but thank you for bringing this forward, and I'm excited to see that the amateur sports is happy to help too, and they do great work up there, and so I'm excited. Thank you.
Representative Juergens, final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lilly, for also being a co-sponsor on the bill. And again, this bill does not try to supplant any work that's already being done. It's just supplementing what the Lofoot Foundation and others already are doing. And I agree with Representative Lilly. It was fun to meet Jesse Diggins, and really I just wanted to give her the platform to talk about something that was important to her. And so I'm just pleased to be able to do that. Thank you very much.
And Representative Jurgis, I will tell you, she is truly an inspirational individual, not just from her athletic capabilities, but just from her personal attitude of positivity, which was really nice to see during the Olympics. So with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4392, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Franke, House File 3661. Members, this is an informational-only hearing on this bill. And he gets extra bonus points. I noticed that Representative Jurgens didn't bring treats, but Representative Franke did.
Olympic cookies.
Oh, welcome to the committee, Representative Franke, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and sticking with tradition, I did bring treats from Supermom's Bakery, which is located in St. Paul Park in my district. Madam Chair, members, House File 3661 is a bill that appropriates money for the Beyond the Opioids Project. It's $1.6 million fiscal year 2018 appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Administration that grants money to TPT and Amper's Radio to deal with the opioid epidemic, the Beyond the Opioids Project. I have just a few words on this that I'll get to later. We'll just get right to the testifiers, and they can talk about what a great project this will be.
Mr. Straczynski, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm with Libby Law Firm here today representing the Friends of Minnesota Public Television. It's a pleasure to testify in front of your committee once again, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Representative Franke for bringing this initiative forward, and thank you for giving us an audience today to talk about something that's very, very important. This legislation really is, we've been talking to a number of people, and all of you are familiar with what's going on with the opioid epidemic. So we've had a number of conversations with a variety of constituent groups and interested parties, and everybody has their own personal stories about this. So in trying to figure out how to get your arms around this, what's one of the best mediums you can use to encompass the entire aspect of this issue? And we thought using our resources in public media, public television, and certainly Amper's to do a project would be very beneficial for all of our communities. Madam Chair, members, this kind of follows what we did last year with Minnesota Remembers the Vietnam Project, which we created. The legislature graciously funded that project. We leveraged the funds we received from the legislature several times over to bring forward a massive program, including other details like the wall that heals. You'll hear about the Vietnam, about the opioid wall we're talking about a little bit later. But anyhow, we just thought that we are in a good position to go into every community in the state of Minnesota, to go into every school district in the state of Minnesota, and to every county. We can reach everybody through our air in a variety of ways. And so we wanted to present this idea to you today and let you know that this is $1.6 million request. It's not the size of the project. It's what we're asking the state of Minnesota to invest in this project, because we envisioned this project to be over $3 million. And so with that brief introduction, and I want to thank you. And by the way, Madam Chair, I have to tell you that we've worked with the Department of Administration for the last couple of years on a variety of legacy grants, and specifically our appropriations that you generously have provided. We've talked to them about this project. They're wonderful to work with, and we appreciate all the work that they do. They're very conscientious about their task, and we appreciate that. And they may need a little assistance financially to help administer this, and we'll deal with that a little bit later. But they do a very good job, so. Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to Katie Carpenter, if I can, from Twin Cities Public Television.
Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Katie Carpenter with Twin Cities Public Television. Committee Chair Anderson, Vice Chair Nash, members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to be here today. According to the New York Times, in 2016, more than 62,000 Americans died of a drug overdose. This number surpasses the total U.S. casualties from the entire wars in Vietnam and Iraq combined. Not a day goes by that we don't hear a shocking statistic like the one that I just read, or see news headlines about another life lost in our community, or the devastating economic impact that it has on our country. It's really clear that our nation is in an opioid epidemic. But now is the time to go beyond the news cycle and allow for a space for personal storytelling and to hear missing narratives that can really bring us a lot closer to this issue and to understanding what addiction truly is. It's also an opportunity for hope and prevention and ultimately healing. As Bill mentioned, this past year I've been leading our Minnesota Remembers Vietnam Initiative at TPT and across the state, which is a statewide collaboration launched by Minnesota's six public television stations, the MPTA. And this is an initiative aimed at uncovering and preserving Minnesota's untold stories about the Vietnam War. I'm really excited that now, because of this initiative, we have a proven model for inclusive storytelling, education, and outreach that can literally impact millions in our state and beyond, across the nation. The impact goes beyond the numbers. This is the type of project that actually builds community and inspires people to talk to each other, to share their own perspectives, and most important, it builds deeper understanding. TPT and the MPTA will again join forces for this initiative, along with the Association of Minnesota Public Education Radio Stations, AMPRS, who also have a proven model of success in storytelling and outreach. One example is their recent Veterans Voices initiative. And we are excited to launch a $3.1 million education initiative that is called Beyond Opioids. And this initiative, we hope, will do four key things. One, it will educate through powerful storytelling. The partners will create diverse peer-to-peer audio and video testimonials by and for real people whose lives have been touched by opioids. This will include short-form and long-form storytelling and documentaries. We will also mobilize and involve youth, as their perspectives and fresh energy will definitely help us with the larger push for change at all levels. Number two, we will empower people to share their own stories. We have a vision for creating something similar to our Minnesota Remembers Vietnam Story Wall that is a very inclusive platform online for anybody who has a personal perspective to share. Could easily do that in a safe way. And this will also be a space where people can build empathy. And it also, we know from our past initiative that this really makes people think and act differently. Three, this initiative will connect Minnesotans to resources for prevention and recovery. The initiative will include a high-profile, integrated Beyond Opioids media campaign highlighting the work of critical nonprofit organizations across the state that are leading the way in education, prevention, and recovery services. And all of those three components that I just mentioned will really be driving towards the fourth, which is prevention. We want to prevent opioid abuse before it starts. So TPT, AMPRS, the MPTA, all of us will join forces to reach out and collaborate with educators, community-based influencers, and policymakers like yourselves so that we can learn and share responses to the epidemic. Leveraging the power of public media and a broad collaboration of community partners, like I just mentioned, as well as medical professionals, educators, and all of us in the room today, this initiative will help Minnesotans find and advance real solutions to this epidemic and prevent misuse and addiction, and break down the silence and the stigma that so often keep people from seeking the help that they need. So together, we can move beyond opioids. Thank you so much for the time today. I'd like to introduce Joel Glazer from AMPRS.
Thanks, Ms. Carpenter. Thank you. Mr. Glazer, welcome to the committee. If you'd please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Members, for the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I am the CEO of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. As most of you know, AMPRS represents 18 independent community radio stations throughout the state of Minnesota, getting up as far as north as Canada and down as far south as Winona, Mankato, and Rochester. The majority of our stations thrive on serving underserved communities. I mention that because it is the underserved communities that are currently being hardest hit by the opioid crisis. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, African Americans are twice as likely to die of an overdose than whites. KMOJ here in the Twin Cities, known as the People Station, serves Minnesota's African American community. Native Americans are five times more likely than white Minnesotans to die of an opioid overdose. Four of the Amper's radio stations are Native American stations, and they happen to be the only Native American stations in Minnesota. I also had a congressional staffer recently tell me that in Minomen County, the Minomen County Sheriff informed him they are responding to an overdose per day, not a death, but an overdose just the same. 365 overdoses per year in one Minnesota county alone. There's no question those are staggering statistics, but they are just that, they are statistics. The fact of the matter is the opioid crisis is much more than a number. It's a crisis within our communities. It's a crisis involving real people, your constituents, and friends. And this project is about people. People sharing their personal stories, stories of success, but also stories of failures and loss. To combat the opioid crisis, there's no question we need more Narcan, a drug that can reverse an overdose. We certainly need more treatment centers, but we also need more outreach, education, and prevention, and that's exactly what this project will do. It will grab people's attention with compelling, relatable stories and educate them about where they can find help specifically in their local community. As I wrap up, I would like to echo Mr. Straczynski's thanks to the Department of Administration. We have 18 stations, 17 of which receive grants through the Department of Administration, and the work that they do to help us is invaluable, and we do appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Glazer. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frankie, for bringing this bill. It's just a very huge issue, and I wanted to comment when Ms. Carpenter was speaking and mentioning the Vietnam project that you've been overseeing, and I participated in the launch of that, the screening that you did, and it was an incredibly compelling evening, and I brought along with me a Vietnam War veteran who suffered greatly as a result of his experience and became an author, you know, telling his own story, which was a part of his healing. And the points that you made about what the intent would be for to replicate what you've done, the great work that you've done for the opioid crisis, I can just visualize, having been there, how impactful this would be. And so thank you for your testimony, and the stories, the part that I'm remembering now was the four or five individuals on the stage that each throughout that evening told their story, and how I won't forget that. And I think that this bill has the potential to really bring that, start that conversation, and as a result it will make a difference. So I'm hopeful that we can move on this.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frankie, for a great bill. I know you care a great deal and have brought forward bills into HHS, which I also sit on, so thank you for that. And I think that the testifiers did a great job highlighting how education is such an important component of that, and for us in state government finance, the purview that we have in touching the work that you do. I think this is a great bill, and I do want to just, I know this is an informational hearing, and talking about the financial piece of it, that we do think about education as one component. As was mentioned, there are a lot of components to addressing this, and to do that, we need you know, substantial funding, whether to touch any aspect of this. And I know this is just a small bill in terms of the grand scheme of things, but it really does partner with everything else we need to do. And so I hope that, you know, this session we can see things move forward to give us dedicated revenue so that we can invest in education and, you know, whether that be the penny a pill or whatever it may end up being, but that we do that because it gives us the opportunity to use that funding to invest in education like we're hearing today, or even be able to make sure the Department of Administration can administer to these grants and have been so helpful to these groups that are testifying. And so I hear you, and I think this is a great bill, and education is a huge component. I'm also hearing we need to do a lot, and we need to make sure we have the resources so that we're not just using funding from here or there, but we have dedicated revenue to really tackle what we're hearing today. So thank you for bringing this bill forward.
Members, any other questions? Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Frankie, for bringing this bill forward. I appreciated, as we're talking about this crisis, that it is clearly statewide, and there are certain communities that are impacted in a really major way. My life, as well as the lives of, I'm sure, even people at this table, have been impacted by the opioid crisis. So thank you for this. Could you just speak a little bit more to just the storytelling component of how you'll be gathering these stories?
I think I would refer to the different, to TPT and APRS on their different, so I'm guessing it'll be a little bit different for each area.
For sure. Thank you.
Ms. Carpenter?
For this, we plan on doing something similar to our story wall aspect of our Minnesota Remembers Vietnam initiative, which was, it's an online website at mnvietnam.org that has a Share Your Story page, so anyone who has access to internet can go in and share their own perspective. But we also paired that opportunity to share online with a lot of outreach where we'd go into communities, and we actually tried many different models of story sharing. We've had opportunities in panels to share stories. We've sat one-on-one and done video. We've done video interviews. We've helped people just sit down and write their own story. We really want to leave it open to however the person feels the most comfortable sharing. And I think we need to tailor it a little bit. Once we learn more about what people are going through with opioids, it'll be a little bit different than the Vietnam community that we've been working closely with. But I think we want to keep it very open, and I think the story wall kind of technique is a very inclusive way for anybody to share, even anonymously, too. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. I think there's an... I think you probably have something to add. I think that there's also an opportunity, as we're talking about, just even folks who have access to internet. We know that that is an issue throughout the state. There's several organizations who are working on this issue, and I'm sure you're connected with them. I think there's some of us at this table who could also help navigate some of those relationships. The one other question I actually had is, can you talk a little bit about what the best age is to start educating young people about the issues of opioid abuse?
Mr. Glazer?
Madam Chair, Representative Flanagan, if I may take just a moment to step back to your first question, then I will address the second. In addition to what Katie was mentioning, there are several other very important aspects of how we will be reaching out and connecting. First and foremost, connecting with treatment centers in local communities, because it is going to vary by community. We are already, this is not something new for AMPRS by any means. We're not jumping on the bandwagon here. We have been doing a lot in this arena, especially our native stations, because that is a problem, and that has to be treated very differently than how it's addressed in the African-American community. So we work specifically with the communities to make sure that the messaging is community-specific. But also, we have already made a connection with the Minnesota Department of Health, who has a very well-established peer-to-peer educational program. And if you've heard, I mean, we're already, that is what we do, is peer-to-peer. We have already talked to them. They are just, they're waiting in the wings, ready to connect us with those peer-to-peer counselors. It is a little bit more challenging to find people to step forward in a situation like this. Veterans, everyone said that would be hard. Honestly, that was a little easier probably, but there are still plenty of people, especially when we already have those peer counselors. As far as your second question, Representative Flanagan, as far as the age, I'm going to say that that's something we would still have to figure out. I would defer to the schools that we are working with. Many of our radio stations are affiliated with schools, either directly or indirectly. Most of our native stations are actually housed in a school. Minneapolis North houses Jazz 88. So we would work with the counselors and the teachers to figure out. It would be a guess on my part, and I don't feel comfortable guessing. That's something we would want the experts to provide us with feedback.
I could just mention one quick thing about that. Ms. Carpenter, thank you. We are just kind of starting the research process, and we're uncovering new things daily about your specific question. I was talking to a teacher at one of the MPTA partners, and she said it's just shocking. You know, she said, really, you need to get to the young. You know, she said it's just shocking. You need to really target them at a very young age because, you know, by high school it's too late. She said you really need to get into middle schools. So I don't know the specifics, but it sounds like, you know, maybe a middle school target would be a good thing to consider.
Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be brief. I would say, Representative Flanagan, if you have not had a chance, look at the Minnesota Remembers Vietnam Project. I saw it on Channel 2, and it was phenomenal. The different aspects of how they approached the veterans and the discussions and the different types of panel discussions versus peer-to-peer discussions and things like that. And then I was also, as a member of the Veterans Committee, provided with a CD from the AMPRS programs. So they were both done. It was marvelous. It was just great. And your second question, that's one of the things other than this that I'm going to start looking into is age appropriateness. I'm looking at, you know, where and how did certain DARE programs come to be, start to fall off, and where do we start to address this situation and at what age level might be appropriate. And that might be different from geographical area to geographical area. I don't know. But it is something that I'm personally going to start looking into down the road.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think we might be forgetting one group here is maybe the medical field. According to your information here, testifiers that they prescribed 3.5 million prescriptions back in 2016. I think probably you should be maybe working with some of our medical people in the medical field and bringing some information out there too. So,
Representative Frankie, final comments?
Thank you, Chair. I would just like to say that this is a great bill. It's going to do a lot of things. It's going to inform, educate, prevent people from all ages, all areas across the state. And just want to address the funding aspect. If we do move Representative Baker's bill forward, we should be able to get the funding for this project. So I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, for the time to bring this project to light and help draw attention to this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frankie, for bringing this issue forward. We are very impressed by the treats that you brought today, and we would encourage you to have us take a tour sometime. So, yes. So close to the Capitol.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Frankie. Representative Knobloch. Actually, Representative Knobloch, before you come forward, members, I just want to point you in the direction of a couple of things in your packets today. So, right now, we're going to be going through Representative Knobloch's bill and Representative Jeff's bill, and it's dealing with appropriations and funding for government in the case of a shutdown. And the Ways and Means Committee back in February had a committee hearing to discuss this issue. And in your, I'm having the page handout, I took some of the documents that were part of that presentation that I thought would be helpful for us today as we take a look at it, and I just want to highlight a couple of things. We've got basically two versions that we're looking at here today. We've got a lights-on version and what I would consider more of an automatic appropriations version that we're going to be looking at. So it's two different approaches to situations where there's not agreement at the end of session to adopt a budget, which we are constitutionally required to do. Only two states currently have something of this nature in the nation. Wisconsin, theirs is about 50 years old. It's commonly used, and it's been as late as November 4th in 1971 that they actually settled And then October 27th of 2007 was the latest that they settled on a budget using this form of continuing appropriations. The other state that has used this is the state of Rhode Island, but they rarely invoke theirs. So just those two states actually have something along these lines. But I want to point out, too, in your packet, so those documents that you just got handed out to you, I'm trying to find where mine are. So the first one, this was prepared by fiscal analyst Bill Marks, and I just want to point out that in our budgeting system, we have different ways of handing it. We've got the direct appropriations, which is what we do when we pass our budget bills, but then there's also statutory appropriations, and that can include anything from property tax credits, county program aid, local government aid, things of that nature, tax refunds, and so forth. Those are examples of statutory appropriations that happen no matter, in essence, they just continue regardless of whether we pass a budget bill or not. And then there's the forecasted appropriations, and those are things like entitlements, and hopefully Ms. Roberts will correct me if I've got either of those wrong. But when you look, if you back out the statutory and the forecasted amount, they consume about 80% of our $46 billion general fund budget. And so really these two bills, well, at least the Jessup bill is dealing with about 20% of the budget from that $46 billion, and Representative Knobloch's is a little bit more fluid on the percentage that it addresses. So I just want you to take a look at these documents to get yourself familiar so you know what the terminology is as we have these bills presented to us. And then I'd also encourage you, if you do have some extra time, it would be worth your time to take a look at the February 8th Ways and Means Committee hearing that discussed this at length. Part of this was spurred by the reaction of the court dealing with the legislative funding veto by Governor Dayton. Now, their court ruling was dealing just with the legislative funding issue, but some want to examine if that is just limited in that scope or if that would mean for any continuing appropriations down the road. So with that, I just wanted to give you guys a little bit of a primer, since not all of you serve on the Ways and Means Committee. But I'm going to have Representative Knobloch present his bill, and I'm going to move House File 3891 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. And with that, Representative Knobloch, Chair Knobloch, to your bill.
And Madam Chair, I'd appreciate it if you'd move it and adopt the DE1 amendment.
Members, in your package, the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author wishes. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Chair Knobloch.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. House File 3891 as amended provides for certain state programs to continue being funded even if no budget agreement has been reached as of July 1st in an odd-numbered year. I have actually traditionally opposed bills like this. I have felt the deadline of June 30th ought to be enough for the governor and legislature to get their work done. I wasn't here during the 2011 shutdown, but I was here in 2005 as Ways and Means Chair when we had a smaller, less consequential shutdown. The environment bill that year and some other bills were signed into law before June 30th, so state parks remained open and most state residents really didn't see any effect from that particular shutdown. What has changed? In the recent Supreme Court case between Governor Dayton and the legislature, the Supreme Court has changed the landscape. Their opinion called into question the constitutionality of a district court acting to appropriate money, as the Ramsey County District Court had in 2005 and 2011. Future courts, based on this Supreme Court decision, will likely be much more cautious about taking the role that the Ramsey County District Court has taken, meaning Minnesotans in the future will likely face a much harder shutdown of services than they faced in the past. I have largely modeled my bill on what the Ramsey County District Court ordered funded during the 2011 shutdown. Most spending is limited to the amount spent during the previous year, except for a few categories. Those categories include disaster relief, debt service, and certain dedicated expenditures like highway construction contracts, whose funding such as the funding dedicated to roads in the Constitution from the gas tax, can't really contribute to helping with a general fund problem such as we would face during a budget crisis. Other categories of funding are mainly that authorized by the Ramsey County District Court during the last budget crisis, except I do allow for state funding of state parks and state historic sites for the first 2 weeks of July. If we're going to have a short shutdown, I don't see any reason that everyone should have their 4th of July vacation ruined. I also do fund the governor, the legislature, and the courts at the previous year's level of funding, so there can't be any one branch of government putting undue pressure on the other branch to come to some sort of settlement. And in reference to what Chair Anderson showed you in terms of the statutory appropriations and such, this bill does not fund, it specifically exempts statutory appropriations and other appropriations from being funded unless they are on the specific list that is in the amendment that you adopted. This bill won't be needed unless there's a government shutdown, and of course we hope we never have one of those again. This sort of thing has only historically happened when we have a big budget shortfall, and the difficult trick, I think, in designing a bill like this is to do three things. Number one, you've got to provide enough funding that truly critical services will not be shut down for even a short time. But two, you want to cut funding enough so that members of all political persuasions do actually have an incentive to come to an agreement. Finally, I think you need to provide enough flexibility for the executive branch. They really can deal with any emergency situations that might arise. I believe this bill does that. I appreciate Representative Jessup bringing forward his bill. His bill really has started the process on this, although I disagree with the particular approach he's taken. I should mention that Representative Carlson has co-authored my bill. The one change in the amendment you adopted from the original bill is that it really has the executive branch making the appropriations rather than the courts, which is what I had in my original bill. And after talking to a number of attorneys on staff, they felt there were some constitutional problems with that approach, and so going with having the executive branch do the appropriations is what I ended up with. If we as a legislature objected to what they were doing, we could, of course, sue them. That would then go to the courts, and the courts would determine if the executive branch was really following the law or not. I finally want to say that I think we should do something on this during this year. We're fortunate that we have a budget surplus. It's an even-numbered year. We don't have any sort of imminent situation happening where a law like this would have to be put into effect and used any time we can see in the foreseeable future. And Governor Dayton has also expressed some interest in doing something on this. So with that, I appreciate your consideration on this important issue, and I would stand for questions.
Okay. Is there anyone that wishes to testify to this bill? Members, any questions? Representative Guam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Knobloch. My freshman term was when we had that shutdown, and the governor happened to do some meetings around the state, and I attended one, and he had me sit in to his right, and we were going through, and someone brought up an issue with food banks and not having funding to be able to, you know, even get the food out that was in the food banks, and that had slipped through the cracks of, oh, this is critical. How would your legislation as amended handle an oversight that popped up, you know, 4 years from now, 3 years from now, that, you know, maybe weren't aware of and put into here? What mechanism would there be to take something that's obviously overlooked as being critical?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I guess first I would say I hope we don't overlook anything. And if people have other ideas of things they think are critical functions that aren't in the amendment, I am very open to hearing about it. You know, in terms of the food bank issue, I guess I probably would want to know a little bit more about that? Are you, you know, is it a case where, I mean, food banks didn't have the money to deliver food to other food banks, or what was it? I guess I could see it possibly falling on page 1, line 19 of the amendment underneath the other emergency assistance funding category. But I guess without knowing a little bit more about the circumstance, I'd have a hard time drawing up opinion on it.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Knobloch. My whole concern about this is I think it's very commendable to try and prevent, but my worry is that we miss something, and that if we have reasonable ways of taking care of oversight, and it might be a program that's developed and passed next year, that, you know, that's the only reason I brought the question up is we always miss something. We're not perfect. And if our legislation allows for flexibility but not abuse, but I commend you for this attempt.
Madam Chair,
Chair Knobloch.
Representative Quam, I guess I would say that if we missed it and we didn't do this bill, not only would it not be funded, but nothing else would be either. So you'd still be in the same situation. You know, as far as, you know, new programs that we think up that aren't funded, you know, I don't, for the most part, have specific programs named in here. It's more, you know, a collection of principles that were laid out by the Ramsey County District Court. So, I mean, if something met the requirement of, you know, one of the number of issues in here, you know, food safety, let's say, or something like that, since we're speaking of food or emergency assistance, well, then whatever that new program was, it could conceivably meet that criteria. If it didn't meet that criteria, whatever it was, it wouldn't be funded.
Representative Driscoll. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Chair Knobloch, thank you, and I will also thank Representative Jessup when he brings his bill forward. I think this is something that absolutely needs to be looked at and addressed. I, like Representative Quam, was here my freshman year in the 2011-2012 cycle, and I think that the governor's office and the legislature, as well as the judicial branch, has learned a lot from that process, and all parties have attempted to try to find a way within the confines of their duties to come to an agreement on this. And so one of the concerns that I have, and I'm not going to speak specifically to the bill, but more to the concept, is the courts have made it pretty clear that they feel that they do not have the authority to authorize emergency funding. So if in the unlikely event, an unfortunate event, that Minnesota finds itself in a situation of a 2011 end of session, regardless of who's in control, the things I get concerned about is the rhetoric that would be raised about, well, I guess we have to open up the state prisons and the sex offender facilities and let those folks out into the community because we don't have money to pay employees. And I don't think we have the ability to issue warrants, money on the come, for pay for people. So I think that something needs to get done this year for that. And I think that you're spot on when you say that there's an appetite in the governor's office to try to do something to resolve this issue. And I laud you for coming forward on this. And I believe that there are several ways that we can handle this, and I appreciate you bringing one alternative forward to the legislature. Thank you.
Chair Knobloch, I've got some questions for you. So I'm looking on the DE1 amendment on page 2, line 24 and 25. And on here, it's kind of going through what critical functions are. And it says, protect the rights afforded to the citizens of Minnesota under the federal or state constitution. And with this change, you've made it that it would be left up to the governor then to make these decisions. To me, I'm just curious, what could that all, would it be left up to the interpretation, I assume, for the governor to determine what is protecting the rights afforded to the citizens of Minnesota under the federal or state constitution?
Madam Chair, you know, my bill as originally written had the courts doing it because of some of the concerns raised, and Representative O'Driscoll mentioned some of them. It seemed to make more sense constitutionally to go and have the governor do it. We are then delegating to the governor this decision on, you know, when you interpret a statute like this, you know, a line like this, what does that mean? I mean, what's going to get funded? And you know, certainly I think public safety, law enforcement, you know, the courts are all things that I would say fall in underneath this. Now, I've got the courts funded separately elsewhere. I can certainly conceive of issues coming up that I probably can't even imagine right now that might fall in underneath this. And if the legislature or someone else felt the governor was wrong in funding a particular area underneath this statute, then they'd have to sue and let the courts decide. And this is really language that was taken from what Ramsey County District Court had laid out as their principles back in 2005 and 2011. And so that's why I chose to do this. I certainly think, I mean, it's the job of the state to protect people's rights. And so that's something that should be in a provision like this.
Well, thank you, Representative Knobloch. You know, I too was here in the 2011 situation where they could not come to an agreement. And there was a lot of disagreement when the special master was appointed on whether or not they were meeting what the language is. And so I get really concerned about provisions that with this, having a governor, whoever that may be, it would be really left up to their interpretation. And then the legislature, whoever that may be, wouldn't have a whole lot of say about how that went forward. So in that situation in 2011, we were at about a $5 billion, $6 billion deficit that we were facing. So is it possible that a governor could determine that the entire budget is providing the rights afforded to the citizens of Minnesota under the state and federal constitution? Is it possible that they would continue those appropriations and potentially exacerbate the budget deficit that we would be faced with as a legislative body? Is that a potential? Is it possible?
Madam Chair, I guess I wouldn't think so. I guess, you know, firstly, I would point out that all the items listed here from page 2, line 18 forward, you're restricted to not spending any more than you had spent in the previous year. So certainly a governor could not spend more money, and they couldn't take, you know, line, you know, page 2, line 24 and somehow expand that. I think that, you know, there are some parts of the budget that I think it's fairly clear if you go to the very end, for example, that higher education would be something that we would not be funding other than allowing them to use their reserves and use tuition to continue with their operations, but we wouldn't have higher education expenditures as part of it. I think that by, you know, if the governor really did just take that view that every single dollar of the state budget is something that preserves people's rights, well, then the legislature would probably take that to court. And I suspect that based on past precedent, even the committee hearings we're having now and the testimony that we'll take, that the court would say, no, that wasn't the legislative intent.
And so, Chair Knobloch, in your bill, though, you say no statutory appropriations, but you still leave in the forecasted appropriations, which would include entitlement programs. So with the entitlement programs tending to increase every year or continually, is it possible, though, that the governor, being broad and saying we're just going to continue everything that we have going forward, that would, in essence, have us spending more money because the entitlement programs themselves keep growing without anything, without us doing anything? So would we potentially be exceeding what our budget would be just because the forecasted are still included in this?
Madam Chair, no. If you look at page 2, lines 18 through 21, it specifically says that for all the other critical functions that are named in the bill, except for those very few in the beginning, emergency services, debt service, their spending can't exceed the previous year. So, yes, even forecasted programs, they could not spend more than the prior year. Okay. You know, when I looked through this, Madam Chair, I tried to do some figuring as I looked through the budget and said, well, okay, we don't have higher ed being funded. You know, there are some areas within the budget of this committee that wouldn't be funded. You know, in terms of education, the way it's laid out, we fund federally mandated special ed. We fund the formula, but we don't fund a number of other programs within education. I would roughly guess that you'd have, depending on how the governor interpreted some of this, say what they did with LGA and such, you'd probably see a 15 to 20% saving over the prior budget.
But, Mr. Chair, that still would be left up to the discretion of the governor that was in the office at the time, correct?
Well, Madam Chair, to some extent on some of these things, yes, but I think it's pretty clear if you look through the list that there are a number of things that are not on that list.
And Chair Nublock, how does the timing for a lawsuit, I don't know if, and this is probably outside, and I'll maybe ask Mr. Gearing offline, just curious, if there was any objection that the legislature had to any of these, governor decides I'm going to fund all of this but not this, I'm just curious as to what the recourse would be for the legislature, how that process would work then to sue over any disagreements on this continuing appropriation, and then the timeline for that. We saw here with the legislative funding issue, you know, it took quite some time despite its point supposedly being fast-tracked. I don't know if you've given any thought to that time frame. If there was a problem we had to sue, how would that play out, and where would that put us in the budgeting process? Would we be then looking to a court decision in November or beyond that? Do you know, did you look at that at all, or do you know time
frame? Well, Madam Chair, I guess I don't have a specific time frame in here. We certainly could, I suppose, try to require something like that, although you probably get into some separation of powers issues there too. But if we are in this situation, remember, we've got the budget deficit. The governor, whoever he or she is seen as the head of the state. I think most people are going to be looking to them first to be solving the problem. And if they are spending lots of money that we don't have and attempting to push the envelope, I think there's going to be a backlash against them in the court of public opinion. And so I would think that they would not be able to permanently keep spending far more than the legislature thinks they should be spending.
And then one last question before I let other folks ask some questions too. Chair Nublock, we've had situations in the past where there have been disagreements on what the final budget would be, where we have passed certain bills, like the ag finance bill typically gets passed. Some of these jobs bills, some of these other bills, they've actually passed, been signed into law by, the governor at that time. What happens in this situation where there's maybe three or four bills that have been signed into law and kind of the outliers are like the K-12 bill or the Health and Human Services bill and the tax bill? For those that are already signed into law, can the governor then decide with this authorization to change what the funding would be for those three that have already been passed and signed into law? How does that work so that if there were cuts in those bills that were passed and signed into law, does this then supersede that and so that he could go to or she could go to whatever they want? How does that work?
Madam Chair, committee members, no, this does not supersede that. If you look at page 1, lines 5 through 8, we passed some bills beforehand, those bills would supersede this. And so those critical functions covered by those bills would be off the table as far as this particular bill goes.
Okay.
So if, for example, we had already passed the K-12 bill, well, now everything in K-12 would be funded, and we would not be holding back some areas of K-12 funding, which we otherwise would be doing if this was in effect.
Okay. All right. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. And Chair Nublock, I really enjoy this discussion. I think it's an interesting bill and concept. And I started my legislative career, and I remember Representative Olson bringing up a continuing resolution every day that we met in special session. I'm sure you remember that. Just it was his
call. I remember it was a different Representative Olson than the one sitting next to you.
Very much so, indeed, Chair Nublock. I've noticed some similar. No, I have not noticed any similarities. Sorry, that was mean. No, it's she's yeah, cool. Very different times. Yeah, he was quite a character. But at that time, I remember going through that each of those days, a special session. But I also remember the impacts. So it was fascinating to me the essential versus non-essential, and just how that all works out. And that's my only kind of general concern is sometimes we. I mean, it's pretty easy on essential to figure out, you know, public safety things, for example, or what they, you know, there's some clear ones that, you know, keeping people locked up and those sort of things. I thought it was interesting in your bill on 322 on your delete all. It's I really enjoy that one. To make sure the zoological gardens and Department of Natural Resources secure animals, including safe and necessary to prevent animals from escaping and endangering the public. So, I mean, so that's a good thing you got that one in there. You know, some of them, like the non-critical, were that's always, I find, tricky. Because, and I'm sure you'd appreciate that, too. It's just surprising what becomes, you know, we might not think of non-critical, but sometimes is. I don't know if you remember the wayside rest when we had to shut those down. And for whatever reason, people couldn't make it to the next gas station, and they just... You know, we're using trees and whatnot, you know, to, you know, it was just crazy. I don't know what happens to humans, but they couldn't make it an additional 3 miles to the rest stop. So, I mean, clearly it's not essential, but it's, the public obviously couldn't figure that out. And then remember the shutdown where, you know, it became, and we're going to hear from the horse people later, but, you know, they shut down the tracks and is that, but it seemed like between the tracks and the, what finally kind of snapped things was when people couldn't get the horses and the beer. It was kind of the beer kind of, when all of a sudden we shut down beer in Minnesota. I always thought it was Wisconsin, but apparently beer is very important in Minnesota as well. So that became critical, if you will. So anyways, I'm going on, and I'm sorry, Representative Olson, because you're very different than the former Olson. No, it's just... I'm glad to have the discussion. I enjoy it. I think it's good that you're bringing it forward, and I just always am troubled a little bit with the non-critical, and I don't know the answer, and I'm glad, but I'm still glad that you're bringing it up and we're having this discussion.
Well, Chair, no. Madam Chair, just several quick things. I guess first of all, I've not used that word essential anywhere in the bill, and I understand that state employees, you know, back then there was. You know, some feeling of, gee, I guess I'm not essential, and, you know, I don't want that. But I guess we do need to sort of define somehow, and certainly some functions are more critical than others, and so I've tried to use that nomenclature. The zoo language was actually in the Ramsey County District Court opinion before. I just drew the language from there. Talking about the horses you know, gambling regulations and how the horse track got shut down in 2011, because of the shutdown. That's one thing that I tried to deal with in this bill is if you look at, you know, the horse track and gambling regulations and some of these occupational boards, they're basically funded by fees that the people who are licensed pay. And we're not going to be able to use those fees to bail ourselves out of the general fund budget crisis we've got if we've got a shutdown. And so to me, it doesn't make any sense to shut those things down if they're not going to be able to in some way contribute to solving the problem. And so in this case, I allowed those to stay open. You know, the trick in doing this is we want to have something that if we face a situation like this, we don't want to have one group of people here, you know, say maybe the more liberal side suddenly decide they want to vote against this because it, you know, if they came to a deal, we'd have to cut even more. And so, I mean, there's going to have to be a certain amount of pain and cutting if we have a budget crisis. And so we don't want to create a situation where the more liberal side says, oh, I just am comfortable with it as it is because then we're going to probably be running up bigger and bigger obligations and having a problem. But on the other hand, for the conservative side, we don't want to create a situation where conservatives say, well, gee, I always wanted to cut government. Here we are. Why do I want a deal? I mean, we want to have a bill that brings both sides to the table with an incentive to come to an agreement, and this is tried to be designed to do that.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Chair Novlik, final comments?
Well, Madam Chair, this is, I think, an important issue. It's certainly an issue I hope we don't face again, but we've faced it twice in the last couple decades, and now with the Newport landscape, I think it's something that we should do something about. And I certainly am open to people's suggestions and ideas on this. If you have them, please contact me, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Chair Knobloch, and I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3891, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. Thank you, Chair Knobloch.
Thank you.
Representative Jessup, House File 3360. Welcome to the committee, Representative Jessup. I'm going to move House File 3360 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. And looks like you have an amendment. It's not his amendment. Oh, it's not his amendment. All right. Well, we'll get to you just doing your bill first.
You can do it if you want.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, and thank you, members of the committee, for the opportunity to be before you today. This bill before you is really a culmination of efforts that have gone from prior legislators before me. So I can't, I cannot take any ownership to creative license here. There's probably a few revisions, but this is really some work that has already been accomplished. And it began with Phyllis Kahn, as my understanding. I have not met Phyllis Kahn as of yet. So at some point, I'm sure that will occur. And then last year, this particular or legislation very similar to this was offered before you as a committee from Mary Kanesh Bodine, Representative Kanesh Bodine, and I was hoping that she would be here, but she's up on an effort in Alaska. Any event, I wanted to just mention this. I think you as a committee went ahead and included it in an omnibus bill last year at 95% of funding. It is coming before you, a couple of revisions at a 90% level of funding. My interest in this particular subject really began when I was a citizen back in 2011. And I recall the state shutdown. I think it was the first year of the governor being here, and it was like, oh my gosh, you know, here we go. We've got a legislature and we've got a governor who just can't get things accomplished. And as I think all of us anticipate, Minnesota citizens, they want to see us come together and get things done. Well, for about 20 days in 2011, we were in the national news. We were not in the national news for a good reason. We were in the national news for a very bad reason. Often we hear about Minnesota being ranked number one, number three, number five on a very, you know, good aspect of life here in this state. But in this situation, we were not being viewed very positively on a national level. And I think, Representative Lilly, you kind of hit upon it. We had the former Supreme Court Justice Kathleen Blatz. She was involved with determining what is an essential function of government that needed to continue and what is a not critical function of government that should not continue. What finally broke the logjam was the beer distributors. The beer distributors needed to go ahead and renew their license to be able to distribute the beer to grocery stores. I shouldn't say grocery stores, but to all of the, I would say, the liquor stores, as well as the restaurants and other establishments around the Twin Cities and throughout the state. The beer license that these distributors needed, it was not a critical function of government. It was one of those non-essential functions of government, and yet I would say that if you asked a typical Minnesotan, was that an essential function of government? They probably would have said yes, it was an essential function of government. And at that point, really the logjam broke and a budget was accomplished and we moved forward. Not everyone is happy, but at least we moved forward. What I would like to say is that for those 20 days, that was a bad time overall as well if you were a Minnesota citizen. Because I think for some of us, we lost the convenience of being able to be serviced by the state in a number of different ways. state parks closed. We had the rest areas were closed. A number of initiatives were closed all across the state. And I was looking through the list. You'll appreciate this. Even the campaign finance and public disclosure board was closed. Now, I know that disappoints all of you. But my point is that during that time, I think it was kind of a black mark for us as far as a state government. And it did not bode well. I mean, if you were a citizen, your faith in the state, your faith in public servants, whether to be the governor or to be the legislature, kind of took a little dip. And I don't think that's where we want to be. We are a state that has been lauded for good governance. And I would say this is an issue, and I'm pleased to hear some of the comments that have been made here. This is an issue that we probably need to deal with. What's the right form and so forth? I guess that's up for all of you to really decide in this matter. But as often we come before one another to present legislation, we often want to present legislation that we say, okay, this is a solution. We can get sides that are on both sides of this issue to really come together, and we say this is the right thing to do. This is a very odd piece of legislation because I want to say at the very goal, we want to make this legislation onerous. Onerous to all. This is not one where we're going to please people. We want to make it onerous so that we do not actually see it enacted, that we always see a budget accomplished. And we would hope that it would always be accomplished. But the Supreme Court last fall really established that the judicial branch does not have the constitutional authority to fund government, like has happened back in 2011 with Ramsey County Court. So I applauded Chair Knobloch here. He did have this Ways and Means informational hearing, and we got to hear from Myron France, you know, commissioner of MMB. And he also said, you know, with what the court is telling us based upon the ruling on the governor's veto, we really do think that we need to do something here. There may not be a stopgap if we ever get to a scenario again of a budget impasse between the legislature and also the governor. So I think it behooves us just to be responsible to come up with some legislation that is onerous such that it really is a motivation to make sure that we do get a budget accomplished somewhere in the future, whether some of us are here or not. The legislation you have before you is kind of a little bit more simplified approach. It's kind of a cutting approach. All of the, we'll say, base appropriations would continue at 90% level. Now, we could debate whether it should be 90%, 95%, 85%, but I think it needs to be a cut, and I think it needs to be onerous to all, the legislative branch as well as the executive branch. But I think overall, one of the benefits of doing something of this nature is it leaves all of those functions of that are operating today for state government, it leaves them in place once we get into a new budget year if we don't have that budget in place. It does not define what is an essential service from what is a non-essential service. Because I would say that average Minnesotans, there's a lot of people that would say all of these services are equally important. You'll get a variety of answers on that particular point of discussion. I would also like to say that at 90% of an operating budget, it's going to cause issues. An agency could run most likely for up to 3 months would be my expectation. If you've got managers and directors in place, there's ways for them to cut back and prune on some of their spending, at least for the short term. But overall, it's going to be an increasing situation where there's going to be greater and greater stress. And that, I think, is also what we want, because at the end, we want to get a budget accomplished and for the state to move forward. We do not want to make this a situation where it's comfortable to continue to operate without an approved budget by the legislature and the executive branch. I've spoken too long. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on this bill? I see Mr. Holton is on the list. Do you wish to testify? Or? Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon. My name is Court Holton, and I represent the Minnesota HBPA, which is an organization of thoroughbred horse owners and trainers. I was very much involved in the 2011 litigation. I was probably the most spotlighted attorney in that whole process, and it was a little ironic because one of my very good friends was presiding over the case as a district court judge, and she ruled against me just about every time. The process that we were using in the past has absolutely no legal authority to support it. It makes sense, but there's no legal authority. The authority for the issue that we're talking about here is Article 11, Section 1 of the Minnesota Constitution. And I don't know if you knew him in the House, but there was a staff legend in the Senate named Peter Watson, who was there for his entire career. He was excellent. He wrote an essay on the purse strings of the people's money, where he made it very clear that there is only one entity with authority to spend money from the Treasury in Minnesota, and that is you people sitting right here, at least the ones that have election certificates. And our issue is statutory appropriations, which was totally botched by the court in 2011. The money for the Racing Commission comes from us in the industry in the form of fines, penalties, but mostly license fees. That money flows into the state. It goes back into a special revenue account, and by your edict is appropriated to the Racing Commission. So we have an appropriation. In 2011, there were a number of activities that had no appropriation that were allowed to continue, and there were a number of entities that had an appropriation that were forced to shut down. The way it worked is the governor made a list of things to shut down, and the court decided which were going to shut down and which were not. There's no authority in the state of Minnesota for the court making those decisions. In the recent legislative funding case, the court gave strong indication that of how they would rule if they ever had that situation before them. For our interest, all we need out of this process is a clarification on statutory appropriations. However, I thank the two members here for taking on the larger issue because I think it needs to be done. I don't think we can go back to that situation that we were in before. For my issue, a clarification that a statutory appropriation is, in fact, an appropriation, unless and until you people were to amend that law. But right now, it's an automatic appropriation. As the money comes in, you've appropriated it out. That should be clarified. On the larger bill, or the larger issue, I just want to give the benefit of my experience. You know, it's so chaotic when you do one of these things. I was driving around on my iPad as a passenger, writing briefs and getting emails from court administrators and that. But the main principle that I think you have to have in the bill is that the money has to be appropriated. You can appropriate it contingent on circumstances like both bills do, and you can appropriate it on the basis of a formula because you can identify then how much money the legislature has appropriated. The problem that I think is going to be really hard to get around is only you can do it. The executive branch, the judicial branch, cannot exercise the discretion on an appropriation because then you're not doing it. And that's going to make this a lot harder. I think it's doable. I think it has to be done. That process that we went through before, we don't want to do that again ever. And our industry took a beating mm-hmm. on that. People that bring horses and stables up here, have to make plans many, many, many months or a year or more in advance as to how they're going to bring their stables up there, which racetracks they're going to go to. They look at what tracks are offering, what kind of races. Our track has a very nice turf course, for instance, so that brings some turf horses up here, and they have it has to take place for them. If it all gets canceled out, you probably have ruined their year. And the next time we go down to see people in Louisiana or Texas, something, why don't you come to Minnesota? Say, last time I was there, I had to fire all my employees. I lost a bucket of money. I need to know ahead of time that this event is going to take place. And that's our issue. I have some language that I've given to staff. I believe it's under review right now. That would be for Representative Jessup's bill. And I'd like to have some discussion with Representative Nabla, because my understanding is he hasn't had much to do for the rest of the session. But I'll try to stay involved in this. Thanks for the time, Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Holton. I appreciate you coming. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I haven't talked to either authors of these bills, and I'm not here to oppose the bills. I just want to make a couple of points about the local government interaction with the state budget. And, for example, we set our budgets in the fall of each year, and part of our budget is going to be the amount of money we receive in local government aid or county program aid, and we set those levies in December. And so, for example, if this fall we were certified our LGA amounts in July, set our budgets in December, and you were to not be able to put together a budget next year, under these bills we might get less LGA and CPA because of the functions of these bills, and yet we have no way to recover that money or make up that money. So I would just like to work with the authors on making sure that local government budgets can continue reasonably and can be expected, that the monies can be expected to be received. The one other point I want to recall is that in 2011, county program aid and local government aid are standing appropriations. One of the issues that came up in the cases with Judge Geerin was whether we had staff at the Department of Revenue to actually do the calculations and make the distributions. And so that's another part of this function. The monies are appropriated, but there may not be staff at state agencies to make those distributions. And so I want to make sure that we do account for that as we go forward. So, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make those points on the record, and I'll continue to work with both Representative Jessup and Chair Knobloch to discuss how we might modify these proposals slightly to accommodate local governments.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill? Mr. Gehring, I just was hoping you can clear up something for me. So we basically have these two bills, but it's my understanding for the Jessup bill, he keeps funding the statutory and the forecasted amounts, but on the Knobloch bill, it does not fund the statutory items. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. So in the Jessup bill, if you're looking at page 2 of the bill, there's a series of exceptions. So the statutory appropriations would continue as described in the bill. And then as Representative Knobloch pointed out when he was doing his testimony, he has a specific provision in there that suspends statutory appropriations unless they're funded under one of the core function items that are in his bill.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that's the case. Representative Jessup, on your bill, though, too, I just want to talk about how the funds work. Because you include the forecasted and the statutory, that they would continue to be funded under your bill, what we're really talking about is 20% of the general fund. So we're talking about probably $9 billion out of the $46 billion roughly that we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm. That is correct, Chair Anderson.
Okay.
This would be just the appropriations that would normally be approved by the legislature and signed on by the governor in order to continue.
So, Representative Jessup, we're talking about maybe 2% overall of the budget because essentially, right? So,
Chair Anderson, you are very good with your math, and thank you very much. You are astute. If we did this 10% cut on just the 20%, you're talking a reduction in funding of, or I guess of operations of overall 2%.
And Representative Jessup, is that 2% the high water mark? Is it possible that, as I asked Representative Knobloch, is it possible that the forecasted amounts could exceed that 2% because there's just general growth in those areas and entitlements? So is it possible that we would actually be spending beyond that amount?
Chair Anderson, yes, it is. It is always possible. I think the as you're talking about the other spending, that is kind of beyond the legislative control. And so, yes, you could be in that situation. One of the scenarios that was mentioned on the Ways and Means informational hearing is let's take a scenario where the revenue coming in was all of a sudden less than what was going out under this type of a scenario. And we have some, I want to say, what was it called again? Help me here, Mr. Gurney. Was the, is it the unappropriation or, there are some laws in place by which we need to match.
Mr. Gurney, can you help out?
An allotment.
Madam Chair, Representative Jessup, I think you're referring to an allotment.
Yes.
Representative Jessup.
Yes, and so some these unallotment laws would kick in that type of a scenario where all of a sudden our spending, if it by chance exceeded where the revenue coming in to the state was, then that would determine what the spending would be going forward.
And Mr. Gehring, help me remember, on unallotment, that can only happen in December, is that correct? Or is there options to do unallotment prior to that? And is it, or has it only been historically that it's only happened in December?
Madam Chair, I think it's just the historic practices that's when it's been done, but I'm not sure the statute that provides that authority limits it only to that time of year.
Okay. And then we've got Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Jessup, same comments to you that I had to Chair Knobloch. Thank you for introducing the bill. We do need to look at this issue. The courts over the last 8 years have painted a completely different landscape than what Minnesotans are used to seeing. And one of the things I fear is, and I'm almost afraid to say this, since we do have to put a bill on this individual's desk, but I think that the balance of power has actually shifted heavy to the executive branch, given some of the court rulings and given the fact that legislative veto that occurred on line item, and I'm very concerned that a governor would use this as a tool to be able to, if I can use the word, influence, in quotations, the acts of the legislature to, in effect, get more of what the governor wants and less of what the legislature wants. And last time I checked, we had three equal, stress the word equal, branches of government. And I've been very concerned about this over the last 8 years as I've watched what's happened to legislative power and it erode and more of the marbles roll toward the governor's side of the table. So I appreciate this, and I know that back in 2009, 2010, which led up to the last major shutdown, you had a Republican governor and you had both chambers controlled by the Democrats. And so the opposite of that was true in January. We had both chambers controlled by the legislature being Republican and the governor being the Democrat. I do look at blame on both the legislative and the executive branch in bringing us that quote-unquote gift in 2011 and 2012 that many of us had to endure and to resolve. So regardless of which version, the Knobloch or the Jessup or some hybrid or some other, I think this is the time that we need to do it. The governor has indicated that he's willing to do it. And I think it would be a very noble thing if the governor would work with the legislature on the winning days of this biennium to try to put something together to resolve that issue for Minnesotans. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Jessup, I have one more question for you. So part of the conversation in Ways and Means also centered around the issue of line item vetoes. So in your bill, if the governor were to do a line item veto, are we then superseding the authority of the governor, and are you concerned about any constitutional challenges at all?
Madam Chair, Chair Knobloch, feel free to interject on this. I don't recall that being a concern. The governor would continue to have that power for a line item veto. I didn't see that scenario really being interfered with by this particular piece of legislation, but I would open that up for Chair Knobloch to give his perspective.
Chair Knobloch.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my memory on that's a little fuzzy, too, but I think the concern was that, okay, if we are going to continue past July 1st, but we're funding everything at 90% of what it was, the governor loses his line item veto authority to have line itemed some part of that appropriation that was going on at 90%. I mean, if we were to pass a new bill to fund whatever department we're looking at, the governor would have had that authority to line item veto it, and now he or she would be losing that authority.
That's exactly it. And it was actually raised by Representative Hillstrom. Representative Liebling as well raised the issue, and I think Representative Carlson did too, because you would be then, in effect, there would be no longer a line item veto.
Okay.
Because of this. So I assume that based on your response, you haven't looked into that at all. Okay. All right, just curious. Representative Lilly, I understand you have an amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer the A1 amendment.
Representative Lilly offers the A1 amendment to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, my amendment is to the Jessup bill. It's pretty straightforward. So essentially, if the February forecast shows a balance or a surplus, we would continue funding at 100%. Now, here's where it varies from, I guess that varies there from your bill as well, but it varies here. So if there's a deficit, then the funding levels would be a percentage of the revenue expenditures for that year. So if it's the deficit comes in at 97%, then we would fund departments at 97, or if it's at 90 or whatever. So, and that's essentially it. Pretty straightforward. Just kind of general comment before we get to, it's the amendment, but, I'm just more inclined towards like a Chair Knobloch's effort, I think, is a better effort than the one you're moving forward with. And I'd just be more inclined to support that one. But I think this minor tweak would make some sense on this. I find it interesting in this discussion. Well, I'll just go with that. This is the amendment. The rest is to the bill. So thank you. Sorry.
Okay. Representative Olson.
I just want to thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to speak to the amendment as well, just in support of Representative Lilly's amendment. I think the spirit of what is trying to be accomplished and the discussion you offered up leading into this bill, I don't think there's any argument of what we're trying to do and what Chair Knobloch's bill brought forward. But what I appreciate, and to your comment about, like, we need to have motivation to accomplish this regardless of what side of the aisle you're on. And you mentioned yourself that in your bill it's a cut approach regardless. And if you're incentivized by a cut approach, your bill is good. So I feel like, the Lilly Amendment actually brings us back to a place where it's good governance. It's based on where the budget is, where we are structurally as a state based on our budget, and it really takes out that political piece of whether a cut approach is what incentivizes you to actually continue a shutdown. Your bill's kind of good for that. But you add this amendment in, it takes that out, and it says that it's based purely on where we are structurally in terms of budget numbers. And so I think it gives it more of the motivation to accomplish. It takes out that, does a lot of what your bill is still trying to do, which we think is good in the spirit of it, but it really makes that incentive look very different. And I think it takes out that political part. So I just wanted to speak in favor of the Lilly Amendment and hope others can also speak in favor of it.
Representative Jessup, for the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lilly. We could look at a variety of different options on here. I would say I would rather prefer to keep it at the 90% reduction. I really do want it to be onerous, and I want it to be onerous not only to executive branch but the legislative branch, and I also want to see that onerous situation occur for the agencies. I want those agencies to be under stress, to really push for the legislative leaders and for the governor and staff to get together and let's get this budget accomplished. And I think we need to have it a little bit draconian. I do want to respond, Representative Olson, that I know there's always this tendency to think that Republicans simply want to cut government spending. And, you know, if we want to take a broad brush statement, we can go there. I will say, though, that if we are to do this, most often what we will find is that Republicans want to reduce spending in X area or Y area, but not necessarily every particular area across state government. And I think that constituents are going to be equal in terms of their voices of frustration to both Republicans and Democrats on why can't you guys get together and get a budget accomplished. And that's really what I'm after. I want the pressure to be there from the citizens. I want it to be there felt by the agencies to really motivate and press all of us as legislators as well as the governor to make sure that we get a budget and, quite honestly, that we don't go into this type of situation. If we took in a scenario of the budget forecast looks great, we've got a $360 million surplus as we've just experienced from this February, and all of a sudden operations could continue, Representative Lilly, like your amendment, at 100%, there's less motivation for us to make sure that that budget gets accomplished. So I would prefer to keep this at the 90%. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jessup, the cutting word was yours that Representative Olson used. That was the words you used.
Yep.
So that's
I take it.
I don't know if that's what she was referring to, but I heard the words too, and it kind of stood out. And it was kind of what I thought was I alluded to in my opening was why Representative Chair Knobloch talked about the kind of the parallels. And I think any legislation that we do, if we, you know, we're kind of in that place where, you know, many of us like or dislike, sometimes I think it's probably better legislation. And you just kind of were focusing on the cutting and the, those were your words. I found it really interesting in this court proceeding. I'm not an attorney, but I found it fascinating with the governor's veto. It was decided that, like, the legislature wasn't harmed yet, so because we had this reserves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know, you know, you're saying this great pain that is endured by these groups. Well, the legislature essentially, yes, there was fear of our staff that they were going to be mm-hmm. impacted and whatnot, but, you know, they essentially there wasn't that harm that, you know, I mean, I think it's a real harm. Emotional harm is real to me in my mind that we put our staff through. According to the courts, that wasn't harm or wasn't a motivating factor. Anyways, I just think that's interesting. I don't know how you can speak really against, because I think it is a good approach to be fair in the middle. And actually, you know, we had an experience. I think the chair herself had something we were talking about. I think Representative Lunan had a bill on Canterbury or, you know, some of the horses. And I think this is actually kind of similar to what the chair had approached, kind of a more middle of a road, kind of a moving forward kind of a thing. So, anyways.
Representative, any comments? I have a couple.
proceed, please.
Okay. Well, Representative Lilly, I don't know if you remember, actually the amendment that was adopted last year was offered by Representative Dinesh Podein, and that was at the 95% level, and you voted for it. So that's just something that, just to make sure that you remember that part, because I know it's hard to remember from year to year what happens in the committee and so forth. But as far as this amendment that you're proposing, I would just argue I agree with Representative Jessup. I think that this basically puts government on automatic pilot, and we then just say, okay, somebody else take care of our job. Oh, by the way, we're still going to collect our pay. So I would encourage members to vote no on this. Representative Omar.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Jessup, I just had a quick question, or maybe just get a clarity about something that you said you were talking about, there being an incentive for people to come to the table, and there, this bill creating an urgency for all of us to be able to negotiate to get a budget done. And from this bill, what I see is there being more of an incentive for a legislature or a governor who supports a reduction in state funding to not come to the table, because if you are going to get that automatic 10% cut, then it is an incentive not to come because you can just continue to do that. So I just kind of wanted to understand your logic in saying that this actually creates an incentive to come to the table.
Sure. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Omar. Let me give you the one scenario that I guess I would like to play out. If we were to continue, let's say a legislature was here and said, you know what, a 10% cut would be great. Let's do that for a full year. Think of the spending that we have for state parks, for instance, and all of a sudden we did a 10% cut. The state park system would most likely have to cut services. I would say that the average Minnesotan would be very, very, very unhappy if we were to cut state park services. And I would also contend that there are other services that we as a state provide, and it would not be a Republican situation, it would not be a Democrat situation, it would be these are essential services. We as citizens would say these are essential services that have to continue, and I think the pressure would mount that, no, this is not how we want Minnesota to operate ongoing. We want to make sure that there is a realistic budget that is established. And quite honestly, we as citizens, and I'm speaking kind of in the general, I think really put the pressure upon all of us as legislators that if you're going to be elected legislators, then you better come together and you better establish a budget. And I think a legislature that just stood off and said, you know what, no, we're just going to be fine at 90% and we're just going to let things operate, I think the average citizens would say, we want you out of office next election cycle.
Representative Omar, final comment before we go to the vote on the amendment.
I was going to say, I mean, there are a lot of states where this happens. I can think of, like, Illinois, for example, where citizens seem to be outraged for a moment, and the political parties do their blame game, and everybody gets on with life. What I don't want that to happen to Minnesota. And so I will not be supporting this bill.
Representative Lilly renews his motion.
Madam Chair?
Representative Lilly.
Can I just make a quick?
Sure, yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it'll be quick. Just to clarify the amendment, that it was your, I voted on it, but it was yours, it was like your amendment, if I remember right.
Oh, Representative
Kunesh Brunin amended your, was it your motion, or was your, it was an effort by you?
I'm
sorry. So we added, essentially we were making it so that if it's good for, Kunesh Brunin was at 100% and you were at some other percent, and Kunesh Brunin included the fact that if it's good for horses, it should be good for people as well. So that's kind of essentially, I don't know, we could argue this forever. Maybe we can carry on tonight. But I'd like to ask for support of the amendment. I think it's a fair amendment, and it's closer to really parity and balance and good government.
Great. Members, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? No.
No.
Amendment is not adopted. Representative Jessup, final comments to your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee, for the opportunity to be before you. I guess one last comment is I think back to the shutdown of 2011, and again, my perspective was as that of a citizen. And as I looked at that whole experience, I thought, you know what, we were shut down for 20 days. And the real losers, I know from a political party standpoint, we could always cast blame upon the other political party, but I think the real losers in that shutdown was the average Minnesota citizen. We lost some services as citizens. And I also want to say that during that shutdown, we had, I think the estimate was 19,000 state employees that were laid off. And I know that 19,000 versus 5.5 million Minnesotans is a little bit of a contrast, but I do think that all of us here really do appreciate the services that our state employees provide, and they're servicing citizens all across the state. And I got to believe that if I was one of those state employees during that time or even leading up to that time, I would be asking the questions, am I going to have a job, you know, in another week? How am I going to take care of the finances for the family budget? And I think that we owe it as well, quite honestly, to our state employees to make sure that we put something in place so that they do not have to go through a similar experience in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 3360 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. Thank you, Representative Jessup. Thank you, Representative Knobloch, for both of you tackling a very difficult issue, and I appreciate you putting the time in on this important matter. Members, we just have a couple of housekeeping items before we adjourn for the day. We are going to be in recess, or excuse me, not adjourn, but recess for the day. We're going to be in recess until 5 o'clock, and then we're going to come back, and then we are just going to have nonpartisan staff do a walkthrough of the bill. We will not be taking testimony tonight. That will happen tomorrow. We start at 10 a.m. tomorrow, 10:15 tomorrow in this room or room 5, and that's all on your agenda if you need to take a look at that. So with that, members, we are in recess. We're going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, the purpose for this meeting is going to be a walkthrough of the DE2 amendment that is the omnibus state government finance bill. Ms. Roberts is going to walk us first through the spreadsheet. You should have a copy of that spreadsheet in your packets. Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair and members, I will walk through the spreadsheet, and I will also try to mention any significant language that's in Article 1, the appropriations article, so that we don't have to then walk through that again, since it's basically the numbers. The first appropriations changes you'll see are for the legislature, a net of $314,000. That's for three items. First, for the results first transfer from MMB to the budget office. Then there's $104,000 for the reference library for digital preservation of legislative records, and $90,000 one time for a rent, restoring the rent reduction to the Office of the Reviser. Underneath that, you'll see the impact from transferring the $207,000 from the county state aid that currently goes to MMB that will be transferred to the Legislative Budget Office. Under the Attorney General, there's an operating reduction of $1 million per year starting in fiscal year 19. For the Secretary of State, there's $330,000 in a one-time appropriation from the Special Revenue Account. This is from the political party accounts in the Special Revenue Fund from the Campaign Finance Public Subsidy Program, and they are appropriated for the purposes to be the state match for the recently approved federal dollars that are available for election equipment cybersecurity. And then on line 23, you'll see there's a reduction beginning for the Campaign Finance Public Subsidy Program beginning in fiscal 19 and carrying on to the tails. This was the estimate that we received from the fiscal note on Representative Peterson's bill. For administrative hearings, you'll see the $525,000 a year. This is the transfer of the information policy analysis unit from admin to administrative hearings. Under Department of Administration, there are three changes that total to a net of $1.2 million for fiscal year 19. The first is a $300,000 reduction to the State Historic Preservation Office. This represents the money that was in last year's bill. On line 31, I need to make a correction that's labeled incorrectly. That should be the Office of Continuous Improvement. And we will have an updated spreadsheet available later, and that's a reduction of $418,000 per year. And finally, you'll see the piece that's the $525,000 transfer for data practices. Under MMB, there's a net increase of $3.95 million. This is really two pieces, $4 million for the Sexual Harassment Office, and you'll see the items in brackets following that is just a breakout of the different pieces that are specified in the bill. So, and that breakout is actually in the bill language in Article 1, if you take a look at it. And then there is also a $50,000 reduction from the transfer of the results first activity to the Legislative Budget Office. I should note some language that is in Article 1 related to the Sexual Harassment Offices. There is a report required from MMB to the chairs and ranking members of the appropriate committees on the reduced human resources workload and other cost savings that would be realized by individual agencies due to the consolidation of these activities into one office. And then also on line 45, you can see the corresponding transfer of the county state aid from MMB. That goes along with the piece earlier in the spreadsheet. For the Department of Revenue, there is an operating reduction of $3.895 million beginning in fiscal year 19, and then $15,000 in one-time funding for a continuation of the tax incident study. Under the Department of Human Rights, there's a $1.4 million reduction per year, and there is language in the bill that says these amounts may not be used to reduce the operations and services of the department's regional office in St. Cloud. For the Minnesota Historical Society, $1 million in one-time funding for digital preservation and access. Under the Minnesota Humanities Commission, there's a $600,000 total for three different grants. The first is $100,000 for the Healthy Eating Here at Home program, and these are all one-time appropriations. In addition, there's $250,000 for the Everybody Wins reading program, and then $250,000 for a grant to the Minnesota Council on Economic Education to provide staff development to teachers for implementation of the state graduation standards in learning areas related to economic education. And that is that piece I just read is spelled out in the appropriation language. Finally, on this front page, there's a $518,000 a year reduction to the Cosmetology Examiners Board. On the second page of the spreadsheet, you'll see a total of $26 million, and this is to cover to provide funding for three veterans' homes. The first is $10 million for a home in Preston, and then $16 million for the two homes in Montevideo and Bemidji. And I should note that these appropriations are one-time, and they're available until June 30th, 2021. After that, they would cancel back to the general fund. So you can see the total expenditure changes, both direct and open general fund, are $24.3 million. And then there are some revenue changes that I'm also tracking. The first is a $500,000 from a gain-sharing savings. This was a provision that was in last year's bill also. There are some small revenue losses under the Cosmetology Board related to two bills we heard earlier dealing with the hair braiders and eyelash technicians. And then there is a $30.8 million one-time transfer from the stadium reserve to the general fund, and there's language in the bill that specifies that these transfers are used for the veterans' home piece and the sexual harassment office. Finally, at the bottom, you'll see under general reduction, there is language, it's on page 7 of Article 1, that is a general reduction to all agencies related to the MNLARS appropriation. So the money, I'm showing a reduction to the general fund, but then the money is then transferred to special revenue counts in the Department of Public Safety, so that's a net zero to the general fund. So the total changes with the expenditures and the revenue changes is a net of $7 million reduction to the general fund.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Members, any questions on the spreadsheet at all? If not, Mr. Gearing?
So, Madam Chair, I'll walk through the policy items in the DE2 amendment, and I'll start on page 7. So Ms. Roberts already walked through the rider language, so I won't do those pieces. On page 7, I'll just highlight section 14. This is language that requires agencies that have reduced appropriations in this bill to preserve public-facing programs and to make reductions only in activities that relate to central administration and general operations of the office. So in this bill, that would affect the Attorney General's office, Cosmetology Board, and Department of Revenue. On page 8, you see the language Ms. Roberts mentioned in Section 16 related to the MSFA stadium transfer, and then Section 17 requires a minute to prioritize appropriations provided last year, this year, and appropriations that are provided to the department, to the agency through transfers to be put first towards enhancing cybersecurity across state government. So then, Madam Chair, starting with Article 2 is the policy language, and I think what I'm going to do, since there's a number of sections here, is I'm just going to highlight, I'll go through the whole amendment, but since most of these items have been heard in this committee either this session or last session, I'll just kind of hit the high points of each bill that's included. So starting with Article 2, Section 1, there on page 8, this is the first in a series of sections that come from Representative Grossel's bill. This is the Continuity of Government and Emergency Management Bill. So sections 1, 2, and 3 of the DE2 and sections 1, 2, and 3 of the DE2 all relate to the ability of governments to move their seat of government in the event of an emergency, and this is modernizes language that currently only allows for a removal of the seat of government in the case of an enemy attack. Section 4 on page 9 is Representative Anderson's redistricting principles bill. Change from her introduced version of the bill is that this does not include any language related to the establishment of a commission to conduct redistricting. Section 5 on page 11 is more of Representative Grossel's continuity of government bill. Section 6 on the bottom of page 11 is the first in a series of sections that will come much later in this article that relate to Representative Albright's bill reforming the Met Council. On page 12, section 7 is the first in a series of sections that relate to the Legislative Budget Office. This is Representative Vogel's bill. And you may recall from the committee testimony that Representative Vogel's bill generally provides more oversight and reforms the structure of the Legislative Budget Office that was enacted last year. Section 8 is a section also relating to the Legislative Budget Office, but it comes from Representative Schumacher's bill. This is the language that transfers the results first program evaluation activities to the Legislative Budget Office. Sections 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13 all, again, come from Representative Vogel's Legislative Budget Office reform bill. Section 14 on page 15 is new language that puts a cap on the amount of transfers that the governor's office can receive from other agencies at $750,000 in each fiscal year. Section 15 on the bottom of page 15 is Representative Loon's bill that allows businesses to request that their address not be included on the Secretary of State's website if that address is also the home address of the sole manager, shareholder, member, or owner of that business. And this language also includes, to address the fiscal issues that were discussed in the committee, a requirement that the Secretary of State attach a copy of a request form to business filing forms rather than include it as a checkbox on the actual form. Section 16 is Representative Vogel's bill that requires the state auditor to provide CPA firms more opportunities to respond in the event that the state auditor requires more examinations or information from the CPA firm. Section 17 is Representative Anderson's prohibition on the Attorney General contracting for outside legal services on a contingent fee basis. Section 18 goes with Representative Vogel's Legislative Budget Office bill. This provides that the director of the office is a public official for purposes of campaign finance law. Section 19 and a series of sections after this is really the major substance of Representative Grossel's continuity bill. So this language runs from Sections 19, 20, 21, 22, and 23. So that runs through page 27. Starting at the bottom of page 27, section 24 is the first in a series of sections from Representative Scott's bill. This is the policy language that transfers oversight of the Government Data Practices Act and the Open Meetings Law from the Department of Administration to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and that runs a series of sections that goes until page 37, so it runs through section 34. That's all Representative Scott's bill. Section 35 is another Legislative Budget Office provision. This is a requirement that state agencies have to share fiscal note data with the Legislative Budget Office upon request. Section 36 and 37 are the two final sections that go with Representative Scott's data practices transfer bill. Section 38 on the bottom of page 38 is part of Representative Albright's Met Council reform bill. On page 39, section 39 is Representative Anderson's bill that is the base vehicle bill for this amendment, which is the requirement that the Commissioner of Management and Budget provide a website where people can make financial gifts to the state online. Section 40 is first in a couple of sections come from Representative Nash's bill. This is the language that requires that budget recommendations from agencies and their actual IT spend include 3.5% of their IT spend towards cybersecurity initiatives. That's sections 40 and 41. Section 42 at the bottom of page 40 and substances on page 41 is new language that requires state agencies current law allows state agencies to effectively write off uncollectible debts and then are required to report those write-offs in a quarterly report to the Commissioner of Management and Budget. This language requires the agency to include a copy of that report to the legislature in the event that the report shows a write-off of a debt of $10,000 or more. Page 41, Section 43 is language that was in the committee's bill last year that expands the jurisdiction of the Office of Admin Services to include the Campaign Finance Board, the State Lottery, the Statewide Radio Board, and the various pension plans. This includes language that provides that this expansion only occurs once the Chief Information Officer and the can verify that the services provided by the office meet the professional and technical standards necessary for the entity to perform its statutory functions. On the bottom of page 42, section 44 is the first in two sections that require MNIT to provide to consult with local governments on IT projects that involve both state agencies and local government. Section 45 is the next section of Representative Nash's bill that requires 3.5% of a department's IT spend to go towards cybersecurity. And 46 is the second of the sections that require local government consultation and field testing for IT projects that impact both state and local governments. On page 44, section 47 is language that was included in last year's committee bill, which requires that agencies that accrue savings from vacant employment positions only use those savings to refill that position at equal or lesser rate of compensation. Section 48 is a new section that establishes an independent centralized office to conduct investigation and collect data related to harassment, misconduct, and discrimination. This section is the policy section that goes along with the appropriation that Ms. Roberts mentioned of $4 million in the riders to support the work of this office. Section 49 is the first section that relates to eyelash technician regulation. Section 50, these sections are kind of interrelated. You start with eyelash technicians, then Section 50 relates to the hair braiders bill. These are both Representative Moran's bill and Representative Flanagan's bill that are kind of intertwined here. Section 51 is more hair braiding regulation, and 52 and 53 come from the eyelash extension bill. Section 54 and the next few sections that follow come from Representative Lunin's bill. This is the Racing Commission's administrative bill. And that runs through Section 58 on page 51. Section 59 is language that the committee saw last year. This is Representative Garofalo's requirement that the Department of Revenue conduct a tax incidence study to review the tax burden of federal taxes borne by Minnesota residents. And there's an appropriation in the riders to fund this work. Section 60 is Representative Anderson's bill that regulates the transfer of wine from licensed premises from one licensed premise to another. Section 61 is a section that comes from an amendment that was attached to Representative Bliss's lottery bill in committee, and this is language that provides clear penalties for lottery retailers that don't withhold the proper amount of gross receipts from the sale of lottery tickets in order to provide lottery awards to winners. Section 62 is a provision that relates to pensions. This language requires that for dissolved firefighter relief associations that dissolve between July 1, 2018 and July 1, 2028, the funds that would otherwise cancel to a local government must only be used by that government to benefit individual firefighters who are beneficiaries of that plan and may not be used for any other purpose beyond that. Section 63 is the first in the series of substantive sections that come from Representative Albright's reform of the Met Council. The biggest changes here, as you will recall from the committee discussion, are sort of restructuring and resizing of the Met Council and also providing that local elected officials would serve on the Met Council rather than appointees. And that language runs through Section 70 on page 60. Section 71 at the bottom of page 60 is the final in the sections that relate to Representative Vogel's Legislative Budget Office bill. This is the language that transfers a portion of local government aid to the Legislative Budget Office for purposes of conducting, for purposes of preparing local impact notes. Section 72 is language that goes with Representative Grossel's Continuity of Government bill. Sections 73, 74, and 75 are all effective dates to effective dates that go with Representative Vogel's Legislative Budget Office bill from last year. These changes aren't clear in the bill, but in practice would help clarify the way that the Legislative Budget Office would be sort of stood up and gotten into operation. On page 62, section 76, the substantive transfer of the results first program evaluation work from the from Minnesota Management and Budget to the Legislative Budget Office. That's Representative Schumacher's bill. Section 77 is the substantive transfer of data practices and open meetings law oversight from the Commissioner of Administration to the Office of Administrative Hearings. That's Representative Scott's bill. Section 78 is Representative Nash's bill that we heard late last week. That relates to IT software projects. So this is the language that requires Minute to contract out for the purchase or build of enterprise software projects. New language that you see here that wasn't included in his bill are additional terms that must be included in these contracts. Those include a requirement that payment schedules be conditioned on a vendor's demonstration of satisfactory progress, and also a mandate that the agency or that Minute or the agency funding the project must be refunded all amounts paid if the vendor fails to demonstrate satisfactory progress. Also included in Section 78 is language that requires the State Chief Information Officer to recommend a possible recodification language related to Chapter 16E, which is the Minute chapter of statute. Section 79 on page 64 is Representative Keel's bill. This is language that requires the Department of Revenue to study evaluation methods for pipeline operating property in Minnesota. This is language that was included in the committee's bill last year. Sections 80 on the bottom of page 64 is Representative Juergens' bill related to the Nordic World Cup Ski Championship, and this language does include the author's amendment that he offered today to insert the word cup into the title. Section 81 on page 65 is another pension section. This section would increase the benefit available to certain qualifying volunteer firefighters or relief associations. In order to qualify for a benefit up to $12,500, the relief association would have to be funded at greater than 100% of their funding ratio and provide a benefit as of the effective date of the section of $9,500 or more. And at the bottom of page 69, section 82 is the substantive policy that directs the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to apply for federal funding to construct veterans' homes in Preston, Montevideo, and Bemidji. Ms. Roberts mentioned the funding for that this item in the spreadsheet and appropriations article. Section 83 on page 70 goes along with Representative Scott's data practices transfer bill. And Section 84 includes a number of repealers that go with various provisions in this article. And Madam Chair, so that's the end of Article 2, which is the biggest sort of miscellaneous policy article. Then next is Article 3, Administrative Rulemaking. There's a couple of sections in here to highlight. One is Section 2. This is language about policy pronouncements. This is new language that would require that agencies that interpret laws or provide guidance by policy pronouncement provide notice to the legislature and public notice with an opportunity for comment before they can interpret a law based on the public pronouncement. It also requires the agency to delay use of a policy until the legislature has had an opportunity to review that notice. On page 74, section 3 is language that relates to the current allowance in law for small governments or small cities and small businesses to request a waiver from application of a rule to their city or business if it will cost them more than $25,000 to implement the rule. This takes away what is current law, which is an allowance for the governor to waive the ability of a small business or small city to request a waiver. So in other words, with this language, if enacted, it would always be the case that a small city or a small government could request a waiver from application of a rule if it would cost them more than $25,000 to implement. Section 4 on page 74 is Representative Vogel's bill related to residential construction-related rulemaking. Section 5 on page 75 is new language related to the award of fees and expenses to individuals who challenge an agency's application of a policy as an unadopted rule. So this would allow them, if they prevail in that challenge, to seek an award of fees and expenses. And then, Madam Chair, the Section 6, the repealer, goes along with the provisions I've already talked about, and then there's an effective date for this article. Article 4 is campaign finance provisions. Section 1 is language that is in Representative O'Driscoll's bill that the committee included in this bill last year. This prohibits the campaign finance board from adopting most types of rules as of June 1st, 2018, with a few narrow exceptions. And then the remainder of this article is Representative Peterson's bill, which eliminates the public subsidy amounts that would come from the political party checkoff, tax designation checkoff. So what would remain for the public subsidy would be only those amounts in the general campaign fund. I want to highlight the effective date in Section 13, which is on page 83. This effective date provides that the elimination of the party accounts for purposes of the public subsidy would apply for elections that happen on or after July 1st, 2018, so that would include this election cycle. And this language requires the campaign finance board to provide a written notice to candidates who have signed those agreements for this year already and give them an opportunity to sign a different agreement if they choose to do so that would reflect the changes in this bill. The effective date also clarifies that if you're a candidate and you've signed an agreement for this election cycle, it will continue to be valid only for purposes of qualifying for the political contribution refund program. And then finally, Madam Chair, Article 5 is language that the committee has seen before. This is the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority stadium bill. I'll just highlight a couple sections here that may be of interest. One, on page 84, Section 3 is language that provides a process for prepaying stadium bonds based on savings accumulated from reducing the state share of the operating expenses for the stadium. And what's new here is that the prepayment will be based on a four-year cycle so that the commissioner management budget will be sort of accruing over the course of 4 years the state savings, and then after 4 years would use those amounts to prepay the stadium bonds. On page 86, Section 5, you'll see that the policy language here removes a supplemental $20 million allocation to the stadium reserve account from certain designated taxes, and that is reflected in Ms. Roberts' spreadsheet and the transfer from the stadium reserve account. Section 6 on page 87 is some new language that provides effectively a cap on the total amount of the stadium reserve account, and it's based on a calculation that the Commissioner of Management Budget would do that relates to the amount of principal and interest on appropriation bonds that's due in the next fiscal year. Madam Chair, then the next series of pages is language that's either technical language or is identical to what was included in the bill last year. On page 95, I'll point out Section 21, which restricts the MSFA from entering contracts with more than a $5,000 value unless the terms of the contract are approved by the authority at a public vote at a regular or special meeting. Section 24 on page 96 expands the reporting requirement for the authority to include reporting to the Ways and Means and Finance Committees in the legislature and also to the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Sports Facilities. And the report to the Legislative Commission is required to be in person. There's expanded details you see at the bottom of page 96 on the content of those reports. And, Madam Chair, then the rest of that article is largely identical with only a few sort of technical updates to the substance compared to what was the committee saw last year as part of House File 778, which was your bill. And, Madam Chair, that's the walkthrough of the policy.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Members, any questions for Mr. Gehring on the policy piece? Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, on line 70.2, if we're looking at three veterans homes at 72 beds apiece, that would be 216 beds, not 140. Am I correct there, or am I missing something? Okay.
Representative Detmer, it's what the language says is up to 142 beds, or 140 beds. So there might be some facilities that will only have 72 beds or up to 140. It's for each individual.
Oh, each individual. Okay,
yes.
I got you.
Yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Members, any other questions? If not, I'm just going to go through a couple of things of what you can expect for tomorrow. So we will start at 10:15 in room 5. And we will start with getting testimony from the public on the bill. Then after that, we'll go to members' questions and then any amendments. If you have an amendment to the bill, you need to have your name on the amendment so that we know who it is. And if you don't plan on providing it to staff in advance, you need to make sure that you have enough copies for the committee and then also the public as well. And so with that, seeing no other questions, members, we are... Huh? Oh, and